Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How you doing, Matt?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks. Have you enjoyed your little break?
Yeah, I have, actually. I'm trying to work out what your backdrop is. It's not normal. It looks like some building sort of on the...
Down in London in a hotel, in a trendy hotel in Shoreditch.
Oh, very nice.
Trying to keep it real with the kids, you know. we're down for a couple of days, bit of work on.
So nice.
Actually, I think the acoustics are better here. I should be trying to do it here every time.
Should we rent that out? I'm sure we can afford it.
I'm not sure our budget covers Shoreditch hotels. And it wouldn't cover a travel lodge at this point. Unless we get some more listeners and viewers. But yeah, so all good. But who have we got to kick us off? Who's up first?
So we've got Andy Hamilton, who is actually extraordinarily talented guy. The amount of, like, if you just do the customary Wikipedia search, which is probably what I do before each guest, to see the length and breadth, like what spans decades of work he's done of different shows. And one that sort of sticks with me is Drop the Dead Donkey, which is a thing we always used to watch as kids growing up. My dad was a journalist, and so you'd sort of that really resonated in our household. It was something we all watched together, and I remember Outnumbered specifically. But there are so many different things that he's done, and I know he's a massive football fan. He's got a book out which he'll tell us about, but he's great on all the sort of comedy panel shows as well, isn't he?
Panel shows,
yeah.
He's very sharp, very funny, obviously, as a writer. And yeah, I mean, some of the shows that he's worked on over the years, Two Ronnies, Smith and Jones, Not the 9 o'clock News. I mean, real iconic shows from, you know, over the last five decades. And he's still going, still writing, still funny. I met him actually at a charity event in Edinburgh about 14 years ago now. But yeah, top guy, and we're very lucky to have him on the show. Looks different.
Hello. Yeah, you remember me, Chris, is it?
you've changed since I last saw you, Andy. How are you doing?
Yeah, well, you know, you got to respect my choices. That's Libby, who is my IT.
Hi, Libby.
How are
you doing?
You met Libby in Edinburgh, Chris, years ago.
2009.
Was that when it was?
Yeah, I was, because I was trying to remember when it was today. I did a bit of research, and yeah, it was May 2009.
Oh, wow.
Turned the tables, yeah. But how you been?
All right. How's your shoulder? What, have you recovered?
It's kind of ongoing, but yeah, getting there.
I was saying to Chris before, we call it old fartitis in our house when these things start going wrong. So
old fartitis, yeah. Yeah, I run a Friday night, you know, we play five-a-side football and we've all got to be over 50, you know, and there's not one of them. I mean, I've got one, he's on a, you know, he's got a heart condition. I've got one on warfarin. I've got, you know, all of them got arthritis. You know, I've got one plastic hip. I've got one with sort of no real knees. You know, it's brilliant.
Impressive.
What's great is they just get on with it. And every now and then a new player comes along, you know, an invited player. And they'll say things like, oh, I wasn't sure last time I played, I got a little bit of a twinge outside my knee. And you can see all the others go, oh, come on, you know. Yeah, they're still out there, which is the great thing, yeah.
What's the name of your team? You got a name?
No, it's just a five-a-side. We play on the roof of a school in South Kensington. And it's quite a good city because it's 8 flights up to the roof, which is quite a good, basically, if they can't get up the stairs, then they shouldn't be allowed to play.
Who has to go down and get the ball when you knock it over the wall, though?
Well, that is a problem because we wedged the door because we're so terrified of getting locked out on the roof. We wedged the door open with a chair and bags. But every now and then someone hits a shot and it goes through the open door and it can go all the way down. But, yeah. Great just to be out there. So, you know.
So football is your kind of, that's your sport, is it? That's your passion?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing that I do. I play on Mondays as well when I can. That's with younger guys at Hattrick Productions where I do a lot of shows. And it's a really small pitch. It's a cage, you know, AstroTurf. It's tiny. And you can kind of get away with being much older than everyone else because they can't just outrun people, you know. It's too small for that. So it's actually all right. There's a few older guys who play in that game, and we just about get away with it, you know, make a contribution of some kind.
Yeah, you might lose your speed or your power, but you never lose class, do you? But you've got that, the skills, you know, you can do it. You can keep doing it for many years.
Yeah, and I never add any speed. But my game has deteriorated far less than everyone else's, you know, because I never had any. My friend once said that I had quick feet but slow legs. Right, that is right. So, so I've done all right. Touch wood. If you'd said to me, I'd still be playing, you know, at this age, I wouldn't have believed it. But
were you kicking a ball around for as long as you remember? Was that your first?
Yeah.
Life? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because I lived in a house which was right next to a playground. I mean, like six doors away from it was a concrete thing full of broken glass and stuff. But we used to spend all day there, you know, playing football mostly. And then my house was over an arch, and behind it, down the alleyway, was a church hall. And my dad was the janitor of the church hall, so it meant that even in the depths of winter, we could go in there and play a lot of evenings, you know. So,
and was it always Chelsea that was your team, or did you kind of grow to love them over the years?
No, that was the Chelsea was, you know, as I say in the book, that Chelsea was directly, it was like 2 minutes walk away, but our house backed onto Brompton Cemetery, and the ground was just, you know, a couple of 100 yards away. So to walk to the ground for me was a couple of minutes. And yeah, the sound of the crowd was one of my earliest memories. I could hear it, you know, because it used to fill the house. And it was so, so loud in our house that the Chelsea scored, like you'd hear ornaments start tinkling on the mantelpiece, you know. And I was fascinated because every other Saturday, thousands of men swarmed past our window, like an army of men. So I was intrigued by it even before I got to go. And I had a brother who was 7 years older who went every week. So I was itching. I was desperate to go. So I went my first game when I was six.
We used to, our family home was right on the main road in Edinburgh, next to or near where Murrayfield Stadium is. So every time there was a rugby international on, you'd get, as you say, this sea of fans and the atmosphere building throughout the day. And you can't help but get drawn into it, you know. It's amazing how when you're that close to it and you can hear the roar when there's a try scored or when there's an exciting moment, and that it has a massive impact on you, and you kind of you feel part of it even if you're not at the match. It gets you interested to start off with, and then they can spark that enthusiasm.
That's really was maybe the really potent thing I think for me was the crowd. I mean, I went, you know, I went to my first game age six, and I can vaguely remember that moment of sort of seeing the whole spectacle laid out, you know, because Chelsea's ground in those days was quite a coliseum, you know. It was very open, a very open arena, but the terracing got very tall and we were at the top. So you had this whole spectacle laid out beneath you and the colour of the players' shirts and everything. But I can remember that very bit, and I just love being in crowds, and I love going to games, and I trusted the crowds, you know. I mean, looking back, yeah, I was a kid, I didn't realize how dangerous it was, you know, sometimes when the crowd surged or when the crush got back, your feet were off the ground, you know, and you were moving around. But the crowd was always very calm, oddly, you know, and like if it was a crush at the start of the game, gradually it would ease out. The crowd would sort of spread itself like water, you know, and then after 10 minutes, you think, got a little bit of wriggle room now. And then after 15 minutes, you think, actually, this is sort of all right now. And I think that was the tragedy of the when they started boxing the terraces up into enclosures. I think, you know, they made it far less safe. They didn't realize at the time, but that's because they didn't ask football fans.
I see. I used to love, you know, talking about being part of the crowd. I remember going to rugby matches with my dad, and my dad never swears, even now, he never swears in front of me, like, or my sister. Like, he always had a certain level of kind of restraint and decorum, if you like. But we'd go away with, you know, the other friends of his, and you would hear people shouting and swearing in the crowd. And it was always this kind of unwritten thing. We both acknowledged it, but we never actually mentioned it in front of each other. And certainly right. Never mentioned it to my mum, who incidentally probably swears a lot more than my dad. But I used to love that feeling of it was, you were kind of being let into this exciting new world. Yeah. And it was a sign that you were growing up and you were making that transition from being a boy into a man. And, you know, it was, I used to love going to sports events, mainly the rugby. That was always the big one. And then you got to the age where you'd go with your friends instead of your dad to the schoolboy enclosure. And I think he was probably mildly disappointed at that point that I wasn't happening. But no, the crowds are great. But it's, so you've written a book, haven't you, about as a Chelsea fan, blue is the colour.
Yeah. Are we on video and audio, or are we just audio?
We're on both. Have you got the book there? Have you got it?
Oh, flow.
There we go.
That's me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. 6 years old. Yes, so that book is about my relationship with football and Chelsea. And it starts with the first game I ever saw, which was in 1960, Chelsea v Newcastle, when the players were on £20 a week maximum.
Well,
£17 a week in the summer. And then it ends with Chelsea v Newcastle in March last year, which was the game around the time that Abramovich had been sanctioned. And Chelsea's ownership was up for grabs. And they were playing Newcastle again. Only this time, Newcastle had just been bought by Saudi Arabia. And the players were on a lot more than, all of the players were millionaires. You know, even the ones whose careers had not really begun were millionaires. So I just thought that's such a massive trajectory between those two points. So I took those as the start and the finish, and then it's about me and football, really, about how much football has changed, how much of that is partly me changing and how much of it is the game changing, which it has enormously. So it's like a love letter to football, to top flight football, but it's like a love letter from a jilted lover. Who's feeling a bit beast off, you know, because the game has left him a bit. Because I'm not as enthusiastic as I was. You know, I mean, if I'm watching Chelsea on the telly, if they score, I'm probably still out in my seat. But what I've noticed that I've lost is I've lost the dread of losing. I think I've disengaged enough, and I haven't been for the last few seasons. And so... Whereas I think the true fan, you're 3-0 up with quarter of an hour to go, but there is still your heart still in your mouth because you're thinking, I bet we can throw this away. You hear that miserableness in them, don't you? And
What's changed then? What led to you starting to fall out of love, or not fall out of love, but to not have that same absolute passion for it?
I think it was a kind of erosive thing, Chris. I think it was. Gradually, as more and more money flooded in and the game became so much more corporate and global. I was talking to a friend the other day and he's thinking of not going to Chelsea. He's thinking of going up the road to Wimbledon AFC. And I said, what? And he's been a season ticket holder for years. And I said, why is that? And he paused. And he said, I think it's all the bullshit. And... I know what he means. You know, there's a huge amount of corporateness, particularly at Chelsea, and it's and also, I mean, Chelsea have just gone through this absurd experiment where the owners have got this business model, which is fundamentally factory farming young footballers, you know, to try and make money. I mean, it's a business model that may well fail, but that's the one they're pursuing. And so I spoke to another friend who's a fan, and he said he'd been to a game and he suddenly realized there were a couple of the players he just couldn't recognize them because he hadn't seen enough of them. You know, he didn't know. Yeah. And that's like that is like the polar opposite of what supporting a team used to be like. You used to know all the players and you knew them inside out and you got to know them, you know, you even knew their personalities a bit. And even the ones who were rubbish, and every team had at least one player who was rubbish, but was still loved, you know, was still loved by the fans because they were there because of their character, usually because they were wholehearted or, you know, whatever. And so I think it's been a drift. So now I look forward to go, like, if I'm up in Scotland, well, I go see, you know, Libby, my wife's got family in Nairn, and I'll go watch Nairn County play. I'll enjoy that a lot more than if I went to Stamford Bridge now, because it's an experience I remember and recognise. Whereas the experience of watching a game live now is not quite the same. I mean, I still love the sport so much that I probably would get excited. So part of that is probably me getting older and kind of the game's different. The game's different. But I think it is one of the, at the end, you know, I've made various observations in the book, and I do think the game is approaching an existential kind of moment where it's getting to the stage where I think this Super League sort of illustrated this crunch, I think, which is it'll get to the stage where it's so dominated by the money and the corporateness that you begin to ask the question, why, you know,
yeah,
why do it? What's the point of it now? You know,
and I wonder if, you know, you mentioned about Nairn County and I've heard this a lot, people that are actually going back to support their local team, you know, that's in, yeah, you know, non-league or just a, you know, proper grassroots sport. I wonder if there is a trend for that, and if there is more support going towards what people perceive to be real football as opposed to a corporate entertainment.
Yeah, I think there's some big gates happening in the lower leagues. Like Notts County are averaging, I think they're averaging about 20,000. You know, it's extraordinary. There are some big, I think there is that feeling. Also, with the big clubs, if you want to go to a game, if you're not a season ticket holder, but you think you'd like to go to a game, it's an extraordinary palaver. What used to happen was you woke up in the morning and you thought, oh, fancy going to a game. You know, like if Chelsea were away, you woke up in the morning and you thought, oh, fancy going to a game. You look in the paper to see if Tottenham were playing, so West Ham were playing or Fulham were playing. And you'd go and you'd stand on the terraces and you'd watch, and you'd watch great footballers who weren't in your team, but, you know, who you still admired. But there was a spontaneity about it. And if you were a dad, you could just take your kids and go. Now you can't do that spontaneously. The process of getting a ticket is, you know, you'd have to go online. If you probably need to be a member and all that kind of blabber. And so many of the tickets are now taken up by tourist packages. It's quite hard to get in. And the other crucial thing, of course, is the expense. I mean, when I started going, I think it cost me sixpence to get in. That's if they took my money off me, because quite often the turnstile operator would say, I'll just get underneath. You know, guess what they did. Now, sixpence as a percentage of my dad's salary in 1960, you know, I mean, he was sort of middle ranking pay probably, but, you know, it was quite a small percentage of his salary. Whereas now, if you wanted to take a kid to a game, you know, once you factor in everything, transport as well, that's going to be a couple of hundred quid probably. So
yeah,
I think there will be a move towards grassroots clubs. Yeah.
I wondered, is there a point where you were happiest as a Chelsea supporter? Is it the six-year-old, or is it into the 80s, or where are we that you're kind of happiest moments?
My peak football moment was 1970.
Okay.
Because Chelsea had a very attractive, very glamorous, very good team that won the FA Cup that year against Leeds United across two games with the notoriously brutal gladiatorial replay. So that was a great time to be a Chelsea fan. You know, we had Charlie Cook, Peter Osgood, Alan Hudson, Peter Housman, John Ott. Yeah, it was a great team, great to watch. And also, that was the year of the 1970 World Cup, which was in colour, the first World Cup in colour out in Mexico, and had that astonishing Brazil team that was probably the best international team, certainly, that I've ever seen. And that tournament felt fantastically exciting and glamorous, and had some fantastic matches. I mean, the England match against Brazil was almost, I mean, apart from the fact that England lost, it was almost the perfect game, you know, because you had some wonderful attacking play, the amazing bank save, some astonishing defending by Bobby Moore, a beautiful winning goal that Pelé constructed, you know, and it was perfect. So that for me was the peak. And I think from there onwards, it was a gradual detachment. Although obviously, you know, there were still high points. I mean, you know, going there to watch Gianfranco Zola play, or Pat Nevin, or Hazard, you know, there were still high points. But I think from my point of view, emotionally, that was the moment where I was at my most joyfully obsessed, you know.
And in terms of taking part in sport, taking part in football, playing yourself, what was your high point? Did you play for a school team? Did you play just for your pals in playtime? What was your kind of your own sporting highlights?
My prowess. Well, this is going to sound a bit resentful, but I didn't get picked early on because I was tiny. And, you know, first day at secondary school, their idea of a trial to find out, it was basically a massive game of football on the pitch, and the fast big kids got selected. As the years went by, it kind of evened out a lot more, you know, and I started to play the odd game for the school. Mostly I was playing in the playground with my mates, or the five-a-side was more my game, you know, indoors. That sort of suited me better. But yeah, I was playing pretty constantly. But no, I mean, I don't think, unless it's the biggest injury crisis ever, I don't think I'll get to play for Chelsea now. I think I've given up on that.
You can't give up, yeah. No, just never give up.
That was in the back of my...
So when did the writing and the comedy and that side of things take hold? Was it football your first love, and then you became more interested in the comedy, or was it
football and comedy were probably the two great loves? Strangely, they both became fashionable. they weren't fashionable, but I loved. Yeah, I mean, my older brother Pete, who took me to a lot of games, you know, when I was little. In fact, he took me to that first game. He was 13 and I was 6. And we've tried to reconstruct our memories. And he is adamant that we had no adult with us. So can you imagine that now at 30? Like, we'd be in care immediately. But because he was 7 years older than me, it meant that, you know, he was kind of starting to go out with girls and stuff, and I was still stuck at home. So I loved telly. I loved watching, but most of all, I loved comedy. I loved Morecambe and Wise and Steptoe and Son and, you know, and then Monty Python. And so I was a huge fan of comedy. So I suppose without realizing it, that obsession was already Mason, you know, it was, and then later, then I went to university, I went to Cambridge, and I joined something called the Cambridge University Light Entertainment Society, which was a charity that took shows to hospitals, old people's homes, prisons, anyone who couldn't get away, basically. And initially I joined as a driver because I was that unusual thing. I was a student with a car. I had an old Volkswagen Beetle, so I drove the lights and the costumes. But then I was we had a panto at Christmas in my first year, and the guy playing the wicked Uncle Abenaza, it was a hospital for kids with quite a wide range of disabilities. And he got a bit overconfident. He was being Uncle Abenaza, and he was going, I'm so evil. And this little kid down front in a chair, you know, just looked at him and said, you're bad, and punched him in the face. He broke his nose, and he had to go off to hospital. So, and I'd been driving him around. So they said, well, look, you've seen the show. So we did it a bit like they used to do it on the Generation game. They said, right, go on and threaten Aladdin, you know. And so that's how I started. And then... That group used to put on commercial shows in theatres to paying audiences to raise money. And so I started, because the sketches were terrible. The sketches were all inherited from sort of 20 years previously. And so I started doing a bit of writing and performing. And then at the end of my third year, you know, we went up to Edinburgh a couple of times, and we were in a disused Bovril factory in Edinburgh doing a show, and a young BBC producer, a lovely man called Geoffrey Perkins, came and came backstage afterwards and said, who wrote that? And I said, well, that was me. And he said, well, have you thought of doing it for a living? And I hadn't, you know, I really hadn't thought about what I was going to do. I think I would probably have drifted into teaching and become one of those sort of sarcastic teachers who doesn't want to, you know, takes it out on the kids. So under Jeffrey's encouragement, I turned up at BBC Radio. There was a terrific show called Weekending. It was a topical program that accepted material from amateurs. And so I turned up and I wrote a couple of sketches and I got some on. And then I got a commission and, you know, fairly soon I was, you know, a staff writer on that program. And so that was the beginning of it. So it was a kind of accident in that if Geoffrey hadn't come to the show, or if he'd not liked the smell of Bovril because the venue stunk of Bovril, then...
Or if the kid hadn't punched the guy in the nose and broken his nose, giving you that big break, you know.
Yeah. But after I started, I'd been doing it about 3 months, I think. And I do remember thinking, actually, this would be a great way to spend the rest of your life doing this. So I do remember, you know, it wasn't like I spent some time weighing up my options. Pretty early on, I thought, no, this is something I can do, and it's something I enjoy. And I thought, you know, I wasn't sure, but I thought I probably could make a proper living out of it, you know.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But looking back over the some of the shows that you've been part of, that you've written for, that you've co-created, it's incredible. Not the 9 o'clock News, Scotch and Rye, Alas Smith and Jones, Drop a Dead Donkey, Two Ronnies, Armstrong and Miller Show. You know, you co-created
yeah.
a number as well. It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, we should separate them. I mean, things like, obviously, with my friend Guy Jenkin, we co-wrote and co-created Outnumbered and Drop the Dead Donkey. They were out. I mean, some of those credits on the CV, I mean, not that I got to use, I was heavily involved with that at the outset, particularly because I was part of a writing team that had been largely poached from radio. Two Ronnies, if I'm honest, that's one sketch.
That still counts. It still counts, mate.
Strangely, it revolved around the fact that the only bit of English that everyone knew in foreign countries was the words Bobby Charlton, strangely. But that Scotch and Rye, I mean, I did write for Scotch and Rye regularly because they had a lovely producer called Gordon Mingus, and he would ring you about October every year. And he would say, have you got anything for Ricky Fulton and Scotch and Ryan? He'd say, well, what? And I said, I remember one year I said to him, what's, Gordon, what's what thing are you looking for? He said, oh, no. He said, sketches on Scottish themes. And I didn't really know. The only bit of Scotland I knew was Edinburgh during the Fringe Festival. At that moment, you know, I was not yet married to a woman of Scottish heritage. And so pretty much the only thing I knew was a football-based thing, which was I knew about Celtic and Rangers, and I knew about sectarianism. And so I wrote a sketch about Rangers accidentally signing a Catholic as a youth player. So they signed him. They've signed him, and they say to him, no, you're a great talent. You got 8 goals in the first half, our scout tells us, but you didn't get any in the second. What happened? He said, well, I went off. And they said, oh, no, did you get it? He said, no, I had to go to Mass. And Ricky Fulton plays the Rangers manager. And that sketch, I'm proud to say, do you know the program On the Ball with Stuart Cosgrove and my mind's gone blank. Tam Cowan.
Tam Cowan, that's it, yeah.
Yeah. They had a survey, a poll, a listener's poll, to find out the funniest ever comedy sketch, a Scottish comedy sketch. And that sketch won.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
But it was misattributed. It was attributed to another writer. So I had to get in touch with him and say, look, I don't mean to be a bit, I'm not getting Queenie, but I did write that. And luckily, you know, it was on the records and everything that, you know, I was credited. I mean, admittedly, I wrote, it was one of the very few sketches that got longer. Usually sketches got shorter, but in rehearsal they actually expanded it a bit. But so you see, football, that got me past that stage. Then later on I knew a bit more about Scotland because I used to go up there a lot more. And then
but another credit that you haven't mentioned, which is probably should be the top of the list, you were the voiceover for the dentist in Peppa Pig, which would rate very highly in my household.
You're selling it a bit short, because not only was I playing a dentist, I was playing a dentist who was an elephant.
And so multi-talented. How do you get into character for that? When you're not just being an elephant.
I've rehearsed his backstory like any, you know, any proper actor. His backstory for me is that he had to overcome a lot of prejudice.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think the medical colleges, the schools of dentistry, probably initially would have said, you can't be a dentist, you're an elephant. And he had to overcome that. And very, very sadly, the creators of Peppa Pig, even though I've mentioned it to them many times, have never written a scene where he does any dentistry.
I reckon an elephant would be fantastic with the dexterity of the trunk. To be able to, you know, and also, I guess they've got, you know, they've got huge big tusks, so they're probably really into dentistry and teeth and all that stuff. It's,
yeah.
I can totally see it.
I love to see it. Mostly my character just sort of takes his son to the fun fair. that's mostly that kind of thing. But I would love to see him. It doesn't have to be root canal work, you know. It could be, but
we'll push for it. We'll push for it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Because I'm sadly now thinking of it, I used to love watching Peppa Pig, but my boys are a bit older now, so we don't watch it. But I think that Daddy Pig is one of the great characters in TV across the board. Yeah. I just think he's just fabulous.
He's a kind of long-suffering dad. Yeah. I don't know if him and my character are friends. I think they're acquaintances rather than friends. Well, the first time I ever did it, which is many, many, many years ago, they recorded the first series in a studio which was next to a little urban farm in Hackney. Yeah, a tiny little place, you know, quite ramshackle. And so they said, I'm at the microphone, and they were going, okay, Andy, can you do line 7? And then they'd say, just wait for the chickens to calm down. And you wait for the chickens to calm down. And then you do your line, and they go, okay, that's great. Now can we do line 14? Okay, just wait for the pigs to settle. Okay, then you do it. You did it in the gap, being the animal noises. But it took off from the outset, that show. So when I went to record his lines for the second series, suddenly we were in a swanky studio with, you know, no chickens, no animal noises. But
got up in the world a bit, yeah.
Yes, they had. I think the first series have made enough money to. And now it's a global phenomenon. I mean, you know, it's astonishing. It's everywhere.
It's,
yeah.
It's funny how, as a parent, when your kids are small and they've got their favorite TV shows, how drawn in you get to their shows, and how, you know, you sit there, and even if you're on your phone or you're not really paying attention, you really get into it. And I remember I was on the train to London one day, and I spotted Derek Jacobi, who does the voiceover for In the Night Garden, which when my kids were a lot younger, that was, you know, the narrator at the start, yeah. And the little song at the beginning. And it was amazing, because I was just, I mean, he's obviously achieved, you know, he's got an amazing career. Yeah. But what I was like, oh my gosh, yeah. In the Night Garden. You know,
and not I, Claudius.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's incredible how it gets under your skin, the kids' TV shows.
It can get under your skin in another way, though. I find that I still break out in hives if I hear the theme tune to Thomas and Thomas the Tank Engine.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Because my kids, you know, watched that quite religiously to begin with, and it was quite a slow watch.
You know? Yes.
I love Ringo Starr, but he's not one of nature's narrators, you know.
Yeah,
that was hard, but
there's some of them are comedy programs in their own rights, like some of Peppa Pig's very funny. I love the one where,
yes,
I don't know how we've got down this tangent, but where Daddy Pig has this tattered old chair and Mummy Pig takes it to like some sale to help, I think maybe to get a new school roof, and then he buys the chair back, the exact same chair.
Yeah.
I used to love that. I'd watch that a few times.
Well, they are actually the creators. I mean, quite a lot of them are classic sitcom plots.
Right.
I mean, in fact, that plot you described is very similar to Frasier, you know.
Yes.
The dad's chair, you know, and that is a fairly, you know, a kind of domestic story that's got a shape to it. You know, that is a... It's almost classic sitcom writing. And there are jokes for the adults, aren't there? There are jokes about how boring it is to have to sit through a school nativity play, and, you know. But the other great thing is the voices. You know, they've had a succession of real little girls playing Peppa. And, I mean, the first one had a very infectious laugh. So it was impossible to hear it and not feel happy, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the nice thing as well about, well, I guess when your kids grow up and they move on from certain TV shows, there's an element of nostalgia when you look back and you hear the theme tune or you watch an episode or you see a clip of it. But also there's a bit of relief when they get beyond the stage of, like, you know, watching fairly dull kids' shows. I'm not going to name any, but they're just, my eldest is 9 and he's just getting an interest in The Simpsons. my six-year-old daughter, yeah. she just wants to watch whatever he watches. So she's kind of getting dragged along in the slipstream a little bit. But I love the fact that I'm watching The Simpsons. But there's a show called Clarence. I don't know if you've heard of Clarence. And it's absolutely brilliant. And it's got, they showed a huge interest in it. And they've kind of got a little bit bored with it. But I find myself every now and again, they won't even be in the room. And it'll be on. And I'll just sit and watch an episode of Clarence. And I've seen them all. You know, I know what happens. It's not like it's like, oh, it's a new episode of Clarence. It's absolutely brilliant. He's such a great character. And the character is really well written. Even just for yourself, I would try and watch an episode of Clarence. It's great.
I mean, in The Simpsons, it's the most astonishing cultural achievement because that is a show that works at every level. It works for kids. It works for adults. It works as satire. It works as character comedy. And they've maintained, you know, apart from the occasional dip, they've maintained the production standards at a really high level over so many years. Now, my kids, even to this day, they're adults now. They're great hulking adults. You know, two of them are in their early 30s. But they grew up, I mean, kids have got sort of steel trap memories, you know, most of them. So they can perform whole episodes, you know, like round the dinner table, they would do that. And they could do all the voices and they could remember it line for line, beat for beat. And that is a remarkable achievement, you know, because they'll have brought a lot of joy, you know, a lot of houses, you know. And yet it was social satire. I mean, George Bush Sr. denounced The Simpsons. He thought it was destroying American values, you know.
It should be more like the Waltons. Was it less like The Simpsons, more like the Waltons?
Yeah, and they predicted Trump's presidency, you know, and all sorts, you know. You just take your hat off to them. It's remarkable what they've done over the years.
But going back to what you were saying there about, you know, kids remembering and reciting episodes and characters and lines, like back in the day, before we even had a video recorder, or we might have had a video recorder, but you'd all watch the same comedy show at night.
And yes.
You'd desperately try and remember at least one sketch or the lines from it, and you come into school the next day, and the person who could recite with either the best accents, the best voice, the best copying what was on the show, we'd have a bit of kudos, you'd have a bit of status for being able to do that line from the Harry Enfield show or from the Fast show or whatever it was. And it's and I guess that's lost now because you can get whatever you want. You can watch it again and again. But
I wonder if that sharpened memory. You know, the fact that because now, of course, you watch something, you just call it up again if you want to remind yourself. But I wonder whether sort of concentration levels and it's fascinating how it's quite interesting. I thought watching all the tributes to Bobby Charlton, and I was thinking, you know, a great modern player, the vast majority of people will have only seen them play on TV. Very small percentage of people have seen Messi live. But of course, when Charlton started his career, I mean, there would be the occasional highlights on TV and internationals were covered live. But mostly that was, you know, whenever Man United came to town, I mean, whenever United came to Chelsea, the gate went up by about 30,000, you know, that would be like 35,000 average. Suddenly it'd be 65,000. And that was because people were coming to see Charlton the best. And it's quite interesting, that phenomenon, I think.
I think it's not, you're right, it's not the same when you can just access it on your phone. You can watch replays, you can see it all.
Yeah.
I think Usain Bolt is somebody who, even in the modern era of social media and TV and replays and, you know, all the access, I think something about watching somebody, you know, who is the fastest human in history, actually seeing what that looks like in the real world. Because I saw him race two or three times only over the years. And it's something to behold when you can see it with your own two eyes in context against the next fastest human being on the planet. And how slow they look in comparison. Whereas, you know, I think it's something about that. There's a status of that that still draws people in, but it's.
Well, I think there's something as well about, I mean, a 2D image does take the speed out of things. Mm. I mean, the first time I saw Messi play, well, actually, I saw Messi play when he was 17 at Chelsea in a Champions League tie. But he didn't do a lot in that game. You know, you thought, oh, he looks useful, but then I saw him play for Barcelona at Arsenal live, and what TV never quite captures is the speed of him when he's cutting through defense. It's like sort of liquid mercury. He's like mercury, you know. He's it is so fast, and you actually watch it in a state of awe. You think, my God, how's he done that? You know, and clearly one of the reasons why he takes the decision time away from the defenders. He's so quick, they can't decide what to do. You know, he's actually that quick. And I think, so you can enjoy and appreciate Messi on the telly, but that sense of wonder that you might get when you see Usain Bolt in the flesh and see the speed for real, mm-hmm. you know, because close up is always slightly different, isn't it?
Because with Bolt, I was lucky enough with the day job to see him countless times. And what, not just that he was better than everyone else and faster than everyone else, but it was the theatre around him that was so magnificent.
Yes.
Which you didn't always necessarily see on TV, but the little nuances, the little hat tip to the girl who was holding his kit in the, the bucket and all of the stuff around it. He was like an actor. It was just this sort of elongated performance, yes. Both before, during and afterwards, which was just so fabulous.
Yes, it's quite hard. That sense of theatre with great sportsmen is, and maybe, you know, sportsmen take such a beating nowadays if they do anything that anyone remotely thinks is inappropriate or, you know, that I suspect quite a few of them, you know, I know that footballers are coached, you know, rigorously in kind of not, so some of the individualism would disappear, you know, so things like mannerisms that players had and stuff like that. Players used to have more mannerisms, you know, more quirks.
I think, you know, Usain Bolt was, to me, until someone else comes along in a different sport or the same sport in the same ilk, he was like Muhammad Ali. He had the drama, he had the theatre, but he backed it up with his performances. So you could have someone that is a great showman, but how many of them can actually walk as well? But it was, what was interesting was through his career, when he was at the top of his game, how he was able to do all that and do all the dancing around and the laughing and the high fives and entertaining. And then when he was in the final games, when he was really under pressure and he wasn't confident and there was, you know, he wasn't at his best and probably raced one race too many, it was still great to see him compete, but he wasn't at his best. You could see that the smile was a bit forced. He wasn't as relaxed as he was going through the motions of, I'm expected to do the little dance and do the posing. He wasn't the same guy that he was 4 years before or 8 years before. I guess one, you can't fake it. That comes from the genuine belief and the confidence and that, you know, I'm going to do this and I'm not just going to do it, but I'm going to enjoy the whole process and I'm going to put on a show. Yeah. And I'm going to feed off this energy from the crowd and it's going to be amazing. And, you know, Muhammad Ali was kind of before my time, but you look back at videos and interviews and you can see why he was such a draw.
Well,
what a personality.
Yeah, he wasn't before my time and all my generation. We all absolutely worshipped him. And even, because when he first came to the UK, it was to fight Henry Cooper in 1963. And Cooper was about as loved as any sportsman could ever be. And he turned up, he was Cassius Clay then. He was the Louisville Lip. He was extraordinarily brash and flash. And generationally, like, my dad hated him. and that wasn't, you know, there was a lot of politics in there because he was a young black guy and he was confident and he didn't take a step backwards, you know, but everyone really wanted Henry Cooper to beat him, you know, and Henry Cooper did knock him down famously. His trainer, Angelo Dundee, cut his glove to buy them more time in the ring, you know, but then after that, because he was quite gracious, because Cooper opened up with cuts, you know, so the fight was stopped. But then Cassius Clay was quite gracious after that. But then from then on, when he became heavyweight champion, you know, you'd watch him and just the personality and the grace and the electricity of him. I remember there's a fight against Brian London. Have you ever seen that fight? Where he lands a volley of punches, which is like, it's something like 32 punches in sort of 14 seconds or something. It's extraordinary. But then I remember watching, you know, when he, and then of course he refused the draft and he couldn't, but, and we were all rooting for him and he came back and Frazier beat him. And you thought, I remember watching the fight with Foreman. And it was awful because you thought, oh my God, this is awful. He's just, because he did the rope-a-dope thing, you know, for what, 10 rounds. He basically absorbed punishment. And his shtick was that no one ever hit him because they couldn't hit him. He was so quick, you know, it was always, I'm so pretty, no one ever hits me. And he thought, well, this is the opposite of Muhammad Ali. And it was awful. And then suddenly, you know, in, was it the 11th round, he exploded out and put Foreman down with a volley of very fast punches. And it was an extraordinary moment, you know, for a lot of us, I think, just seeing, because we thought we were watching our hero reduced, and then he sprung to life again.
Out of the ashes, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think he wrote all the kind of poetry and the lines and the stuff? Do you think someone was writing that for him, or do you think he came up with those amazing quotes?
I think that was him. Yeah, I don't know. Well, I'd like to think it was him, but... He was remarkable.
So yeah, your ultimate, who would be your ultimate sporting hero then? If not necessarily in football, could be in football, who would be your, you know, all-time greatest sports person you've watched or be inspired by?
Well, if you're talking about the one I kind of love the most, that's Jimmy Greaves. He was the first player I ever fell in love with, and I still maintain there was something extraordinary about Greaves that no striker is emulated, you know. Fantastic a player as Harry Kane is, because, you know, that on TV now, there was no football before the Premier League. But the fact is that Greaves' total of league games, league goals, is way out ahead of Alan Shearer's, you know. So Harry Kane may catch Alan Shearer one day if he comes back to England, but he'll never catch Greaves. You know, Greaves was, but it wasn't just how many goals he scored, it was the way he scored them. I've never seen anyone so light on their feet. When you watch him run, it was almost like his feet kind of feathered the ground, you know. And he always had time, he never blasted. And I watched during lockdown, I discovered this extraordinary website. It was called The Heavy Roller, and I discovered all these archive games from like the mid to late 50s all the way through the 60s. So I actually got to watch a lot of games I watched as a little boy, you know, and compare, you know, and actually it was all right. I thought, oh, this might be a bad road to go down because I might be disappointed, but actually it was fine. But it meant I saw a lot more of Greaves as a young player, you know, and it was extraordinary. And, I described in the book, I mean, when it was announced he was leaving Chelsea for AC Milan, I wrote to him. So I was six and I wrote to him saying, I think it would be a very bad idea to leave Chelsea. But he went anyway. Actually not that long after, a couple of decades later, I was producing a show called Who Dares Wins for Channel 4. And we'd written a sketch which needed the participation of a sort of footballing legend. And Jimmy Greaves at the time was doing TV reviews for Breakfast TV on the Saturday. And he plugged us a few times. He said, oh, it's a great show. So we knew he was a fan. So I wrote to him just on a pun, you know, care of London Weekend Television. And I said, dear Jimmy, this is not the first letter I've ever written to you. I wrote to you when I was six, advising you not to go to Milan. And you've admitted in your autobiography that it's the biggest mistake of your life. So I'm writing to you again. Say, don't repeat the mistake of ignoring my do this sketch. And we sent it to him. And I honestly didn't expect to get an answer. And a couple of weeks went past, and I thought, oh, well. And then I was sitting at my desk, and we had a receptionist who was very nice, but a little bit dozy sometimes. And this call came through. She said, I've got a Mr. Bleaves on the line for you. And I thought, I don't know a Mr. Bleaves. I picked the phone up, and it was an unmistakable voice, you know. It was Jimmy Greaves, and I tried to persuade. He said he loved the show, but he was too scared of doing the show, the sketch in front of a live audience, which made no sense.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that fascinating? Yeah. That you can come with playing football in front of hundreds of thousands of people. But
he played in front of 123,000 at Hampden Park in a Scotland-England match. But he said, but I do love the show, and I'll give it a really good plug. So anyway, on the Monday, I was at my desk getting ready to go to rehearsals, and the phone rang. It was my mum, and my mum didn't normally ring me at work, so, you know, I thought maybe that. And she said, I've just been watching Jimmy Greaves on ITV, and he's just said that we've all got to watch his old mate Andy Hamilton's show. Right. I don't know you knew Jimmy Greaves. I said, well, I don't really. My mum's one phone. Anyway, for the next hour, my phone just kept ringing. My cousin rang. Said, Jimmy Greaves just said you're his old mate. You know, and although, you know, I didn't see him do it, I didn't hear him say it, but I know he said it. And that was actually astonishing. And I was very, when he passed away, I found I was more affected than I expected, you know, sort of having grown up with him. But he's the one I love the most, so I'd suppose he'd be the ultimate hero. But
how good to have had a nice experience with your hero, because a lot of people say you don't meet your idols, etc., but you've got such a nice
I was very lucky. I met George Best in a good way as well. When he actually behaved really well. You know, a lot of people might have stories where he hadn't behaved well. He was pissed, but he actually behaved with huge dignity. There was a moment where a quite elderly woman who was there working for Rivelli magazine was going around with a little dictaphone, getting us all to give quotes as to why we'd been. It was a film I'd done about football called 11 Men Against 11. And George had just come along because he'd been invited. He brought his wife. So she was going around putting the dick saying, why did you get involved with this? 30 seconds, please. On, you know, and you'd say, I'm Andy Hamilton and I'm the writer and I directed it. And then she did a couple of the actors. And then she went to George Best and George said, well, I'm not involved with it. I just came along to watch it. And I'm glad I did because I enjoyed it a lot. I thought it was great. And then she stopped the dictaphone and she said, and you are? And we all went, no. And then he said, I'm George Best. And then he said, I used to be a footballer. And she gradually, she went, oh, you're quite famous, aren't you? Mm-hmm. She said, could I interview you now? And, you know, so many famous people having been, you know, kind of slighted by it would have made their excuse, said, oh, I've got to slip away, you know. But he didn't. He sat with her for about half an hour giving her an interview, and I thought,
wow,
there was a lot of dignity in that, you know. And he was very funny because it was just after Cantona had drop kicked the fan at Crystal Palace, and there's a lot of speculation about what was going to happen to Cantona, and George Best said to us, I think he might go and play in Scotland. He said, because Cantona's very skillful. He said, but he's a little bit slow. He said, and I think, you know, maybe he'll go up to Scotland and play there. He said, that's what I did when I knew I was slowing up. I went up and I turned out for Hibs. And I said, but isn't Scottish football full of pretty rough defenders, you know, Pyle, ain't you? And he looked at me, he said, yeah. But you see them coming from a long way away. But yeah, so I mean, I love watching Best. You know, he wasn't a hero, although he was a hero to people of my generation. We've, you know, because I was in my teens, he kind of was a hero because he was everything that your dad hated. You know, I mean, if you listen to, I watched a lot of Arca, the commentators were obsessed with his hair at the beginning. Once he grew his hair long, they were absolutely obsessed. Like, there's a moment where he gets the ball and Kenneth Waterstone says, "Here comes Best, the barber's nightmare." You know, it was like, but to us, of course, it was great. He grew his hair, he slept with Miss World, he, you know, he was an anti-authority figure and, you know, an astonishing footballer. So he was a hero of sorts, yeah.
Do you find it harder? I find watching sport now, you have people that you have huge admiration for and you're massively impressed by the performance and what they're actually doing, but you never have quite the same hero worship as you do when you're younger. You know, when you're a kid, your heroes as a child they're like superheroes. They're on a different level. And objectively, you could say, well, the modern sports people are way better technically, faster, stronger, further, whatever. But you'll never get the same view of these amazing athletes as you did when you were younger.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you're right. I'm sure that part of it is the romanticization process. But my concern would be whether the young kids now, because they're bombarded with so much marketing messaging, you know, because the one thing, I don't know about you, but, you know, the one thing, you know, so if I had worshipped Greaves or I worshipped Osgood, there was no peer pressure on me to go out and buy a shirt with their names on the back or, you know, there was no merch, you know, there was no. So whereas now, you know, I walk down Camden High Street today and every shop has got these little kids football shirts outside with Messi and Ronaldo. Actually, only Messi and Ronaldo, those two names, the two global, you know, not an Arsenal or a Tottenham player you might expect in North London, but no.
And there's so many things kind of vying for their attention and competing for their attention. So to try and keep focus on one thing for any more than a few moments and the next thing comes along, it's, you know, you know, there's so many sports, there's so many TV shows, films, you know, activities. It's like we're determined to give our kids opportunities and so many things to try and entertain them or stimulate them. It's counterproductive, I think. You don't have enough time to really latch on to something and get under the skin of it and really start to appreciate it and become, you know, a sort of, you know, get a real passion for it.
Yeah, and it is global. I mean, I had an extraordinary, about 6 weeks ago, I was walking down Oxford Street towards the junction at Oxford Circus, and do you know what is on the corner, just next to one of the big department stores? It's a Paris Saint-Germain club shopper.
Wow.
Isn't that extraordinary? Because I thought it, and I thought, Paris Saint-Germain, maybe it's a fashion house. I thought maybe that, but no, I crossed the road, and it is a Paris with Paris Saint-Germain kit and everything in it. It was empty.
Wow.
But I think they probably think that's fine. I think for them, it'll be about presence. You know, it'll be about them saying, we have a PSG shop in all the major cities in Europe, and we've got one in the heart of London's West End. And, you know, and it, you just thought that is a real change, you know, because tourists come to London, and, you know, a lot of them go to football matches, you know, because the package is subbed, and they'll go and see Arsenal or Chelsea or Tottenham. But actually, there is a PSG shop there as well. It's really weird.
Well, listen, Andy, you've been incredibly generous with your time. But before we let you go, with it being Sporting Misadventures, is there a specific low point, a misadventure, something that went wrong, either as an athlete or as a fan, or, you know, something that resonates with you in that vein?
Yeah, I'm not a great golfer, not because I don't like golf, but just because I'm there. But I went to I was in Australia with my friend Guy Jenkin. And we were on an island off the Barrier Reef. I mean, I nearly managed to get myself drowned on the Barrier Reef, but that's a different story. Quite funny. But and it was a place called South Mole, and it's tiny, but it had a golf course. And we thought, well, I think it wasn't 18 holes. I think it was 12 holes. I can't remember. Anyway, so we thought, oh, it's a lovely day. You know, boiling hot because it's Queensland. But yeah, we're about, I suppose we're about 60 miles out to sea, aren't you, off the Barry? Anyway, we got to the first tee and we drove off and I shanked my shot and it went into the rough and Guy did the same. But the problem was the rough was dense rainforest and it was full of the biggest, like there were golden orb spiders everywhere. There were lots of venomous snakes. So, of course, you had a choice. You thought, well, you could go and look for your ball, but you might not come again. So we went back to the clubhouse. We said, you know, and we must have got through about 40 golf balls. And after about three, I gave up. Because, you know, the thing about it was a lovely island, but all of the animals on the island wanted to kill you, you know, and they were, you know. And you could see them. You could see the golden orb spider. They're huge, you know. But it made me think that maybe there was a gap in the market because golf is, you know, golf is trying to widen its appeal. And I just thought that maybe natural hazard, you know, if there were scorpions in the bunkers, so you don't get slow play problems and stuff like that, you've actually got an element of physical jeopardy for the players. I thought that would probably boost the viewing figures with the, you know, the
stress on the tee when you're teeing off. There's enough pressure to try and keep it on the fairway, let alone attack in the bushes and gets attacked by a huntsman spider or whatever.
Yeah, no, that is true. Golf is one game that maybe doesn't need more. I was chatting with a friend the other day. Extreme golf. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, your ball goes in the hole, but there might be something in the hole. You just don't know.
Something for the jungle. What's it?
I'm a celebrity.
That could be the next thing.
Don't fetch your ball out of that lot. Yeah. I was chatting with a mate, and we were talking about he was a big Formula One fan, but he was saying he felt it's got a little bit predictable and boring, you know, and it feels like the computer's driving the car a bit. And so we started busking about how if they brought a bit of real life into F1, you know, so like zebra crossings, you know, or a mum on a school run, you know, just by a chicane or something. Yeah, just little bits of everyday life that just zhuzh it up a bit. But
got to stop and they got to negotiate through an NZP car park with the high curbs and make sure they don't damage their wheels and reach out, get a ticket, and you know the barrier going up and get out.
I think
that's pressure. That when you've got a white car with shiny new wheels getting through at the airport, trying to get the car park, it's scratched in the mud.
And one of those cars that's got that panicky beep if it gets near, you know, if you get within a couple of inches of it, and just, you know, like Beaker in the Muppets, just shouting. I've been, touch wood, I've been quite lucky. I broke my arm once playing football, although I didn't think I'd broken it, so I ignored it, you know, in that very classic male thing of I didn't see how I could have broken it, you know, because it was the ball, and the ball had hit me on the and forced the wrist back up, and it hurt. But I thought, it's a bloody break a bone, for goodness sake. It was a volley, you know, the guy did it pretty hard. And we had that night, it was the BAFTAs, and so we were going to the BAFTAs, so I had to put on a dinner jacket and everything. And by now the sort of bottom bit of my arm was really swelling up. So I got there and I said to my friend Guy, I said, right, I'm gonna have to keep this arm away from people, because I have done something to it. I'll go up, you know, got casually in the morning, and so he said, all right, anyway, sod's law, we won. This was for Drop the Dead Donkey. And what happens after you win is you're dragged backstage for some photographs, and then lots of people want to congratulate you. So I was keeping the arm out of everyone's way, and Guy was kind of shielding me, you know. And then this huge, fat American guy, I've no idea who he was, he just came from nowhere, grabbed my right hand.
Oh, no.
Congratulations, I love your show. I was one of the judges, and guys of the colour drained from my face. Ooh, and I saw them,
oh my God.
And this poor bloke went, oh, I'm so sorry, what have I done? And of course, unfortunately, it meant when I did go up to the hospital the following morning, it was a displaced fracture, and they had to, you know, manipulate it back. And yeah, it was. And they said, oh,
dear.
They said, it looks like it's been displaced. I said, yeah, I think I know who that was. That was quite funny.
Well, thanks very much for your. Oh, sorry.
No, I said, although less funny at the time, is what I said. But yeah. But I'm going to waggle. Should I waggle the book?
Yeah, give it a shake.
Yeah, please do. Blue was the colour.
Wherever you get your books, you should be able to find it. And that's me, age 6.
Have you done an audiobook for it?
Not yet, no.
You need to do an audiobook. You've got a great voice for it, as you know. So, yeah.
Well, it's the right voice for it.
Well, listen, thank you so much, Andy.
It's been
fantastic to chat and great to catch up again. Hope to see you face-to-face, not just virtually.
Yeah.
Sometime soon. Yeah.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, and for your patience with us moving the dates around. So thank you for coming on. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
It.
Yeah, me all too. Right, take care, Andy.
Take
all care. The best.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.